Speaking in Washington at a noon briefing for congressmen, Professor William Garfield of the University of Minnesota said, "Despite what you hear, nobody has ever proven a single gene causes a single human behavioral trait. Some of my colleagues believe such associations may eventually be found. Others don't think it will ever happen, that the interaction of genes and environment is just too complex. But in any case, we see reports of new genes for this or that in the papers every day, and none of them has ever proven true in the end."
"What are you talking about?" said the aide to Senator Wilson. "What about the gay gene that causes gayness?"
"A statistical association, not causal. No gene causes sexual orientation."
"What about the violence gene?"
"Not verified in later research. A sleep gene was reported in rats."
"The gene for alcoholism?"
"Didn't hold up."
"What about the diabetes gene?"
"So far," he said, "we've identified 96 genes involved in diabetes. We'll undoubtedly find more." There was a stunned silence. Finally, one aide said,
"If no gene has been shown to cause behavior, what is all the fuss about?"
Professor Garfield shrugged. "Call it an urban legend. Call it a media myth. Blame public education and science. Because the public certainly believes the genes cause behavior. It seems to make sense. In reality, even hair color and height are not simple traits fixed by genes, and conditions like alcoholism certainly aren't."
"Wait a minute. Height isn't genetic?"
"For individuals, yes. If you're taller than your friend, it's probably because your parents are taller. But for populations, height is a function of environment. In the last 50 years, Europeans have grown an inch every decade. So have the Japanese. That's too fast for a genetic change. It's entirely an effect of environment. Better prenatal care, nutrition, health care, and so on. Americans, by the way, haven't grown at all in this period. They've shrunk slightly, possibly because of poor prenatal care and junk food diets. The point is that the actual relationship of genes and environment is very complicated. Scientists don't yet have a good understanding of how genes work. In fact, there's no general agreement about what a gene is."
"Say that again."
"Among scientists," Garfield said, "there is no single agreed-upon definition of what a gene is. There are 4 or 5 different definitions."
"I thought a gene was a section of the genome," someone said, "a sequence of base pairs, ATGC, that codes for a protein."
"That's one definition," Garfield said, "but it's inadequate, because a single ATGC sequence can code for multiple proteins. Some sections of code are basically switches that turn other sections on and off. Some sections lie silent unless activated by specific environmental stimuli. Some sections are active only during a period of development and never again. Others turn on and off constantly throughout an individual's life. As I said, it's complicated." A hand went up. An aide for Senator Mooney, who received substantial contributions from drug companies, had a question.
"Professor, I gather yours is a minority opinion. Most scientists wouldn't agree with your view of the gene."
"Actually, most scientists do agree," Garfield said, "and with good reason." When the human genome was decoded, scientists were startled to find that it only contained about 35,000 genes. They had expected far more. After all, a lowly earthworm had 20,000 genes. That meant that the difference between a human being and a worm might be only 15,000 genes. How, then, could you explain the huge difference in complexity between the two? That problem vanished as scientists began to study the interactions among genes. For example, one gene might make a protein, and another gene could make an enzyme that snipped out part of the protein and thus changed it. Some genes contain multiple coding sequences separated by regions of meaningless code.
That gene could use any of its multiple sequences to make a protein. Some genes were activated only if several other genes were activated first, or when a number of environmental changes occurred. This meant that genes were far more responsive to the environment, both inside and outside the human being, than anyone had anticipated. And the fact of multiple gene interactions meant there were billions of possible outcomes.
It's not surprising, Garfield said, that researchers are moving toward what we call epigenetic studies, which look at exactly how genes interact with the environment to produce the individual we see. This is an extremely active area.
He started to explain the intricacies. One by one, the congressional aides finished eating and left. Only a handful remained, and they were checking messages on their cell phones.
Neanderthals were the first blondes, stronger, bigger-brained, smarter than us. Genetic mutations for hair color indicate that the first blondes were Neanderthals, not Homo sapiens. The blonde gene emerged sometime in the Worm Glaciation, perhaps in response to the relative lack of sunlight in the Ice Age. The gene spread among Neanderthals, who were mostly blonde, researchers say. Neanderthals had brains one-fifth larger than ours. They were taller than we were, and stronger. They were undoubtedly smarter, too, says Marco Svabo of the Helsinki Genetics Institute. In fact, there is little doubt that modern man is a domesticated version of the Neanderthal, as the modern dog is a domesticated version of the stronger and more intelligent wolf. Modern man is a degraded, inferior creature. Neanderthals were intellectually superior and better-looking. With blonde hair, high cheekbones, and strong features, they would have appeared as a race of supermodels. Homo sapiens, skinnier and uglier than Neanderthals, would naturally have been attracted to the beauty, strength, and intelligence of blondes. Apparently, a few Neanderthal women took pity on the puny Cro-Magnons and bred with them. It's a good thing for us. We are lucky that we carry blonde Neanderthal genes to prevent our species from becoming hopelessly stupid, although we demonstrate plenty of stupidity anyway. He said that pretending blondes were stupid was a dark-haired prejudice designed to deflect attention from the real problem of the world, which is dark-haired shortcomings. He added, "Make a list of the stupidest people in history. You will find they are all dark-haired." Dr. Ivar Nielsen, a spokesperson for the Marburg Institute in Germany, which has been sequencing the entire Neanderthal genome, said the blonde theory was interesting. Nielsen said, "My wife is a blonde, and I always do what she tells me to do, and our children are blonde and quite intelligent. So I agree, there is something to this theory." Dave's first few days in the Kendall household went surprisingly well. When he went outside, he wore a baseball cap, which helped his appearance a lot. With his hair trimmed, wearing jeans and sneakers and a quicksilver shirt, he looked much like any other kid. And he learned quickly. He had good coordination, and writing his name proved easy under Lynn's instruction. Reading was harder for him. Dave did well at weekend sports, though sometimes it was disconcerting. At a Little League game, a high pop fly flew off the field toward the two-story school building. Dave ran over, scaled the wall, and caught the ball at the second-story window. The kids viewed this accomplishment with a mixture of admiration and resentment. It wasn't fair, and they had wanted to see the window shatter. On the other hand, everybody wanted Dave on their team. So Lynn was surprised when one Saturday afternoon, Dave came home early. He looked sad. "What is it?" she said.
"I don't fit."
"Everybody feels that way sometimes," she said. He shook his head.
"They look at me."
She paused. "You're not the same as the other kids."
"Yes."
"Do they make fun of you?" He nodded.
sometimes.
What do they do?
Throw things. Call me names.
What names? He bit his broad lip.
Monkey boy.
He was on the verge of tears.
That feels bad, she said. I'm sorry.
She took his baseball cap off and began to stroke his head, the back of his neck.
Kids can be mean. Sometimes my feelings hurt, he said.
Sad, he turned his back to her. He pulled his shirt off. She ran her fingers through his hair, looking for bruises and other signs of injury. As she did so, she felt him relax. His breathing slowed. His mood seemed to improve. Only later did she realize she was grooming him, like monkeys in the wild. One turned its back to the other while the other picked through the fur. She decided she would do it every day, just to make Dave more comfortable. Since Dave's arrival, everything in Lynn's life had changed. Although Dave was clearly Henry's responsibility, the chimp showed little interest in him. He was immediately drawn to her, and something about his manner or his appearance, the soulful eyes, the childish demeanor, tugged at her heart. She'd started reading about chimps and learned that because chimpanzee females took multiple sexual partners, they did not know which male fathered their infant, and thus chimpanzees showed no notion of fatherhood or fathers. Chimps had only mothers. Dave seemed to have been an abused child, uncared for by his actual chimp mother. He looked to Lynn with open longing, and she responded. It was all deeply emotional and entirely unexpected.
"Mom, he's not your kid,"
Tracy had snapped. Tracy was at the age when she craved her parents' attention. She was jealous of any distraction.
"I know, Trace," Lynn said, "but he needs me." "Mom, he's not your responsibility."
She threw up her hands in a theatrical gesture.
"I know." "Well, can you leave him alone?" "Is he getting too much attention?" "Well, duh, yes." "I'm sorry. I didn't realize."
She put her arm around her daughter, gave her a hug.
"Don't treat me like a monkey," Tracy said, and pushed her away. But they were, after all, primates. Human beings were apes. Her experience with Dave was giving Lynn an uncomfortable awareness of what humans shared with other apes. Grooming, touching, physical attention as a source of relaxation. Eyes lowered under threat or displeasure, or as a sign of submission. Tracy with her boyfriends flirting with downcast eyes. Direct eye contact meant intimidation, a sign of anger. Goosebumps for fear and anger. Those same skin muscles made a primate's hair fluff up to create a bigger appearance in the presence of threat. Sleeping communally, curling up in a kind of nest. On and on. Apes. They were all apes. More and more, the biggest difference seemed to be hair. Dave was hairy. Those around him weren't. According to her reading, the loss of hair had occurred after human beings separated from chimps. The usual explanation was that human beings had become for a time swamp creatures or water creatures. Because most mammals were hairy, their coats of fur were necessary to help maintain their internal temperature. But water mammals, such as dolphins and whales, had lost their hair in order to be streamlined. And people, too, had lost their hair. But for Lynn, the strangest thing was the persistent sense that Dave was both human and not human. She didn't quite know how to deal with that feeling, and as the days passed, it did not get any easier.
Canavan gene litigation ends. Ethics of gene patenting disputed. Canavan disease is an inherited genetic disorder that is fatal to children in the first years of life. In 1987, Dan Greenberg and his wife learned their 9-month-old son had the disease. Since no genetic test was available, the Greenbergs had another child, a daughter, who also was diagnosed with the disease. The Greenbergs wanted to make sure other families were spared this heartbreak, and so they convinced Reuben Matalon, a geneticist, to work on a prenatal test for Canavan disease. The Greenbergs donated their own tissues, the tissues of their dead children, and they worked to obtain tissues from other families with Canavan disease around the world. Finally, in 1993, the gene for Canavan disease was discovered. A free prenatal test was at last made available for families worldwide. Unknown to the Greenbergs, Dr. Matalon patented the gene and then demanded high fees for further tests. Many families that had contributed tissues and money to help discover the gene now could not afford the test. In 2003, the Greenbergs and other concerned parties sued Matalon and Miami Children's Hospital, claiming breach of informed consent, unjust enrichment, fraudulent concealment, and misappropriation of trade secrets. The suit was settled out of court. As a result, the test is more widely available, although fees must still be paid to Miami Children's Hospital. The ethics of the behavior of physicians and institutions involved in this case are still hotly debated. Psychology News. Adults don't grow up anymore. British researcher blames formal education. Professors, scientists, strikingly immature. If you believe the adults around you are acting like children, you're probably right. In technical terms, it is called psychological neoteny, the persistence of childhood behavior into adulthood, and it's on the rise. According to Dr. Bruce Charlton, evolutionary psychiatrist at Newcastle-upon-Tyne, human beings now take longer to reach mental maturity, and many never do so at all. Charlton believes this is an accidental byproduct of formal education that lasts well into the 20s. Formal education requires a childlike stance of receptivity, which counteracts the attainment of psychological maturity that would normally occur in the late teens or early 20s. He notes that academics, teachers, scientists, and many other professionals are often strikingly immature. He calls them unpredictable, unbalanced in priorities, and tending to overreact. Earlier human societies, such as hunter-gatherers, were more stable, and thus adulthood was attained in the teen years. Now, however, with rapid social change and less reliance on physical strength, maturity is more often postponed. He notes that markers of maturity, such as graduation from college, marriage, and first child, formerly occurred at fixed ages, but now may happen over a span of decades. Thus, he says, in an important psychological sense, some modern people never actually become adults. Charlton thinks this may be adaptive. A childlike flexibility of attitudes, behaviors, and knowledge may be useful in navigating the increased instability of the modern world, he says, where people are more likely to change jobs, learn new skills, move to new places. But this comes at the cost of short attention span, frenetic novelty seeking, ever shorter cycles of arbitrary fashion, and a pervasive emotional and spiritual shallowness. He added that modern people lack a profundity of character which seemed commoner in the past.
Ellis, Mrs. Levine said, what is that tube?
Her son was holding a silver canister with a little plastic cup at the tip. They were in the living room of his parents' house in Scarsdale. Outside, workmen were hammering on the garage, making repairs, getting the house ready to sell. What's in the tube? She said again.
It's a new genetic treatment, Mom.
I don't need it.
It rejuvenates your skin.
Makes it young.
That's not what you told your father, she said. You told your father that it would improve his sex life.
Well, he put you up to this, didn't he?
No, Mom. Listen to me, she said.
I don't want to improve my sex life. I have never been happier than I am right now. The two of you sleep in separate rooms. Because he snores.
Mom, the spray will help you.
I don't want any help.
It will make you happier, I promise.
You never did listen, even as a child.
Now, Mom.
And you never got any better. Your whole adult life.
Mom, please.
Ellis was starting to get angry. He wasn't supposed to be the one doing this to her anyway. His brother Aaron was supposed to do it. Aaron was his mother's favorite. But Aaron had a court date, he'd said, so Ellis was stuck with it. He moved toward her with the canister.
Get away from me, Ellis.
He continued to approach.
I am your mother, Ellis.
She stamped on his toe. He howled in pain, and in the next moment grabbed her by the back of the head, pushed the canister over her nose, and squeezed. She writhed and twisted.
I will not! I will not!
But she was breathing it in, even as she protested.
No! No! No!
He held it there for a while. It was as if he were strangling her, the same sort of grip, the same sensation, as she struggled in his arms. It made him incredibly uncomfortable, the flesh of her cheeks against his fingers as she twisted and protested. He smelled the powder of her makeup. Finally, Ellis stepped away from her.
How dare you! She said. How dare you!
She hurried from the room, swearing. Ellis leaned against the wall. He felt dizzy. To have physically accosted his mother like that. But it had to be done, he told himself. It had to be done. Things were not going well, Rick Deal thought, as he wiped pureed green peas off his face and paused to clean his glasses. It was 5 p.m. The kitchen was hot. His three kids were sitting at the kitchen table screaming and hitting one another. They were throwing hot dog relish and mustard. The mustard stained everything. The baby in the high chair refused to eat and spat her food right back out. Conchita should have been feeding her, but Conchita had vanished that afternoon. She had become increasingly unreliable ever since Rick's wife left. Broads stick together. Probably he would have to replace Conchita, which was a big pain in the neck, to hire somebody new, and, of course, she would sue him. Maybe he could negotiate a settlement with her before she went to court.
You want it? Take it!
Jason, his oldest, mashed the hot dog with the bun into Sam's face. Sam howled and acted like he was choking. Now they were rolling on the floor.
Dad! Dad! Stop him! He's choking me!
Jason, don't choke your brother. Jason paid no attention. Rick grabbed him by the collar and pulled him off Sam. I said don't choke him.
I wasn't. He asked for it.
You want to lose TV tonight? No? Then eat your own hot dog and let your brother eat his. Rick picked up the spoon to feed the baby, but she closed her mouth stubbornly, staring at him with beady little hostile eyes. He sighed. What was it that made kids in high chairs refuse to eat and throw all their toys on the floor? Maybe it wasn't such a good idea for his wife to have gone away, he thought. As for the office, the situation was even worse. His ex-security guy had been humping Lisa, and now that he was out of jail, he was undoubtedly humping her again. That girl had zero taste. If Brad was convicted of pedophilia, that would be bad publicity for the company. But even so, Rick hoped for it. Josh Winkler's wonder drug was apparently killing people. Josh had gone way out on a limb, doing his own unauthorized human testing. But if he were sent to jail, that would reflect badly on the company, too. He was poking at his daughter with a spoon when the phone rang, and things became much, much worse.
Son of a bitch!
Rick Deal turned away from the banks of security screens.
I can't believe it, he said. On the screens, the hated Brad Gordon was swiping open doors to the labs, touching petri dishes everywhere and moving on. Brad had been recorded as he went methodically through all the labs in the building. Rick bunched his fists. He came into the building at 1 in the morning, the security temp said. He must have had an admin card we didn't know about, because his was disabled. He went to all the storage points, and he contaminated every single culture in the Burnett cell line. Rick Deal said, He's an asshole, but there's no problem. We have off-site bio-storage in San Jose, London, and Singapore. Actually, those samples were removed yesterday, the security temp said. Someone picked up the cell lines and left. They had proper authorization. Secure e-transmission of codes.
Who authorized it?
You did. It came from your secure account.
Oh, Christ, he spun. How did that happen?
We're working on it. But the cell line, Rick said. We have other sites. Unfortunately, it seems...
Well, then we have customers who have leased...
I'm afraid we don't.
What are you saying? Rick said. He was starting to scream. Are you saying every fucking Burnett culture is gone? In the entire fucking world? Gone?
As far as we know, yes.
This is a goddamn disaster!
Evidently.
This could be the end of my company. That was our safety net, those cells. We paid a fortune to UCLA for them. You're saying they're gone?
Rick frowned angrily as the reality hit him. This is an organized, coordinated attack on my company. They had people in London and Singapore. They had everything arranged. Yes, we believe so.
To destroy my company?
Possibly.
I need to get those cell lines back, now.
No one has them, except, of course, Frank Burnett.
Then let's get Burnett.
Unfortunately, Mr. Burnett seems to have vanished, too. We can't seem to locate him.
Great, Rick said. Just great.
He turned and yelled to his assistant,
Get the fucking lawyers! Get fucking UCLA here, and get everybody here by 8 o'clock tonight.
I don't know if...
Do it!
Gail Bond fell into a routine. She would spend the night with Yoshi, then come home at 6 in the morning to wake up Evan, give him breakfast, and see him off to school. One morning, as soon as she unlocked the door, she saw that Gerard was gone. His cage stood uncovered in the hallway, his perch unoccupied. Gail swore. She went into the bedroom where Richard was still sleeping. She shook him awake.
Richard, where's Gerard?
He yawned.
What? Gerard! Where's Gerard?
I'm afraid there's been an accident.
What accident? What have you done?
The cage was being cleaned in the kitchen, and the window was open. He flew out.
He did not. His wings were clipped.
I know that, Richard said, yawning again.
He did not fly out.
All I can tell you is that I heard Nadezhda shriek, and when I came to the kitchen, she was pointing out the window, and when I looked, the bird was fluttering awkwardly to the ground. Of course I ran downstairs to the street at once, but he was gone.
The bastard was trying not to smile.
Richard, this is very serious. That is a transgenic animal. If he escapes, he may transmit his genes to other parrots.
I am telling you, it was an accident.
Where is Nadezhda?
She comes in at noon now. I thought I would cut back.
Does she have a cell?
You hired her, pet.
Don't call me pet. I don't know what you have done with that gray, but this is extremely serious, Richard.
He shrugged.
I don't know what to tell you.
Of course, it ruined all her plans. They had intended to publish online the following month, and inevitably there would be cries from around the world that their claim was untrue. Scientists would call it the clever hands effect, mere mimicry, God knows what else. Everyone would demand to see the bird, and now the bird was gone.
"I could kill Richard," she said to Maurice, the head of the lab.
"And I will hire the best avocat for your defense," he said, not smiling. "Do you think he knows where the bird is?"
"Probably, but he'll never tell me. He hated Gerard."
"You're having a custody fight over a bird."
"I'll talk to Nadezhda, but he has probably paid her off."
"Did the bird know your name, the name of the lab, phone numbers?"
"No, but he memorized the tones from my cellular phone. He used to make them as a sequence of sounds."
"Then perhaps he will call us one day."
Gale sighed. "Perhaps."
Alex Burnett was in the middle of the most difficult trial of her career, a rape case involving the sexual assault of a 2-year-old boy in Malibu. The defendant, 30-year-old Mick Crowley, was a Washington-based political columnist who was visiting his sister-in-law when he experienced an overwhelming urge to have anal sex with her young son, still in diapers. Crowley was a wealthy, spoiled Yale graduate and heir to a pharmaceutical fortune. He hired notorious D.C. attorney Abe It Ain't There Gansler to defend him. It turned out that Crowley's taste in love objects was well known in Washington, but Gansler, as was his custom, tried the case vigorously in the press months before the trial, repeatedly characterizing Alex and the child's mother as fantasizing feminist fundamentalists who had made up the whole thing from their sick, twisted imaginations. This despite a well-documented hospital examination of the child. Crowley's penis was small, but he had still caused significant tears to the toddler's rectum. It was in the midst of frantic preparation for the third day of the trial that Amy, Alex's assistant, buzzed her to say that her father was on the phone. Alex picked up.
"Pretty busy, Dad."
"I won't take long. I'm going away for a couple of weeks."
"Okay, fine."
One of the other lawyers came in and dropped the latest newspapers on her desk. The Star was running photographs of the raped child, the hospital in Malibu, and unflattering pictures of Alex and the kid's mother, squinting in hard sunlight.
"Where are you going, Dad?"
"Don't know yet," her father said, "but I need some time alone. Cell phone probably won't work. I'll send you a note when I get there, and a box of some stuff, in case you need it."
"Okay, Dad, have fun."
She thumbed through the L.A. Times as she talked to him. For years, the Times had fought for the right to access and print all court documents, however preliminary, private, or speculative. California judges were extremely reluctant to seal even those documents that involved the home addresses of women being stalked or the anatomical details of children who had been raped. The Times' policy of publishing everything also meant that attorneys could put gross and unfounded allegations in their pretrial filings, knowing the Times would print them. And it invariably did. The public's right to know. Yes, the public really needed to know exactly how long the tear was in the poor little boy's...
"You holding up all right?" her father said.
"Yeah, Dad, I'm okay."
"They're not getting to you."
"No, I'm waiting for help from the child welfare organizations, but they're not issuing any statements. Strangely silent."
"I'm sure you're shocked by that," he said. "The weasel is politically connected, right? Little dickhead."
"Gotta go, Lexi."
"Bye, Dad."
She turned away. The DNA matches were due today, but they hadn't arrived yet. The samples obtained had been small, and she was worried about what they would show. The lights dimmed smoothly in the plush presentation room at Salat Annie Koss Limited, the preeminent London advertising agency. On the screen, an image of an American strip mall, blurred traffic rushing past a wretched cluster of signs. Gavin Koss, knew from experience this image was an immediate rapport builder. Anything critical of America was surefire. American businesses spend more on advertising than any other country in the world, Koss said. Of course they must do, given the quality of American products. Snickers floated through the darkness, and the intelligence of the American audience. Mild, muted laughter. As one of our columnists recently noted, the great majority of Americans couldn't find their own behinds with both hands. Open laughter. They were warming to him. A crude, cultureless people, slapping each other on the back as they drift ever deeper into debt. That should suffice, he thought. He changed his tone. But what I wish to draw to your attention is the sheer volume of commercial messages, as you see them here, arranged in space along the motorway. And every vehicle driving past has its radio on, sending out even more commercial messages. In point of fact, it's estimated that Americans listen to 3,000 messages every day, or what is more probable, they don't listen to them. Psychologists have determined that the sheer volume of messages creates a kind of anesthesia, which becomes ingrained over time. In a saturated media environment, all messages lose impact. The image changed to Times Square at night, then Shinjuku in Tokyo, then Piccadilly in London. The saturation today is global. Huge messages, including large-screen video, appear in public squares, along motorways, in tube stations, train depots. We place videos at point of sale in retail stores, in toilets, in waiting rooms, pubs and restaurants, in airport lounges, and aboard aircraft. Furthermore, we have conquered personal space. Logos, brands, and slogans appear on ordinary objects, from knives to tableware to computers. They appear on all our possessions. Consumers wear logos on their clothing, handbags, shoes, jewelry. Indeed, it is rare for a person to appear in public without them. 30 years ago, if anyone predicted that the entire global public would turn themselves into sandwich boards, walking about advertising products, the idea would have seemed fantastical. Yet it has happened. The result is an imagistic glut, sensory exhaustion, and a diminution of impact. What can we do now? How can we move forward in the new era of technology? The answer may be heretical, but it is this. The screen changed dramatically to a forest image, huge trees rising toward the sky, shade beneath, then a snowy mountain peak, a tropical island, an arc of sand, crystalline water, palm trees, and finally an underwater reef with fish swimming among coral heads and sponges. The natural world, Koss intoned, is entirely without advertising. The natural world has yet to be tamed, colonized by commerce. It remains virgin. From the darkness, isn't that rather the point? Conventional wisdom would put it so, yes. But conventional wisdom is invariably out of date, because in the time it has taken to become conventional, to become what everyone believes, the world has moved on. Conventional wisdom is a remnant of the past, and so it is in this case. On the screen, the reef scene was suddenly branded. Coral branches had lettering that read, BP Clean. A school of small fish wriggled by, each winking, Vodafone, Vodafone. A slithering shark with Cadbury curving across the snout. A puffer fish with Lloyd's TSB Group in black lettering swam over convoluted heads of brain coral with Scottish Power printed along the ridges in orange. And finally, a moray eel poked its head out of a hole. Its greenish skin pattern said, Marks and Spencer. Think of the possibilities, Koss said. The audience was stunned. as he had expected it would be, he pressed on with the argument. The slide now showed a desert scene, with spires of red rock rising against a blue sky laced with clouds. After a moment, the clouds coalesced into a larger, misty cloud that hung above the landscape and said, BP means clean power. Those letters, Koss said, are 900 feet high. They stand a quarter of a mile above the landscape. They are clear to the naked eye, and they photograph well. At sunset, they become quite beautiful. The image changed. Here, you see their appearance as the sun goes down. The lettering changes from white to pink to red, and finally deep indigo. So it has the quality, the feeling of being a natural element within the natural landscape. He returned to the original cloud image in daylight. These letters are generated by a marriage of nanoparticles and genetically modified Clostridium perfringens bacteria. The image is, in effect, a nano-swarm, and it will remain visible in the air for a variable period of time, depending on conditions, just as any cloud would. It may appear for only a few minutes. At other times, it may appear for an hour. It may appear in multiples. On the screen, the fluffy clouds became the BP slogan, repeated infinitely in cloud after cloud, stretching away to the horizon. I think everyone will recognize the impact of this new medium, the natural medium. He had expected spontaneous applause for this dramatic visual, but there was still only silence in the darkness. Yet surely they would be experiencing some sort of reaction by now. An infinitely repeated advert hanging in the sky? Surely it must arouse them. But these clouds are a special case, he said. He returned to the underwater image, fishes moving over the coral reef. In this case, he said, signage and adverts are borne by the living creatures themselves through direct genetic modification of each species. We call this genomic advertising. To capture this new medium, speed is of the utmost importance. There are only a limited number of reef fishes common to tourist waters. Some fish are more incandescent than others. Many are a bit drab. So we want to choose the best, and the genetic modifications will require patenting the marine animal in each case. Thus, we will patent the Cadbury clownfish, the British Petroleum stag coral, the Marks and Spencer moray eel, the Royal Bank of Scotland angelfish, and gliding silently overhead, the British Airways manta ray. Koss cleared his throat. Speed matters, because we are entering a competitive situation. We want our Cadbury clownfish out there before the clownfish is patented by Hershey's or McDonald's. And we want a strong creature, since in the natural environment the Cadbury clownfish will compete against ordinary clownfish and hopefully triumph over them. The more successful our patented fish, the more frequently our message shall be seen, and the more completely the original messageless fish will be driven to extinction. We are entering the era of Darwinian advertising. May the best advert win! A cough from the audience.
Gavin, forgive me, came a voice, but this appears to be an environmental nightmare. Brand names on fish, slogans in clouds, and what else? Rhinos in Africa that carry the Land Rover logo? If you go about branding animal species, every environmentalist in the world will oppose you.
Actually, they will not, Koss said, because we're not suggesting that corporations brand species. We ask corporations to sponsor species as a public service. He paused. Think how many museum exhibitions, theater companies, and symphony orchestras are entirely dependent on corporate sponsorship. Even sections of roadway are sponsored today.
Why shouldn't the same philanthropic spirit be directed toward the natural world, which surely would benefit far more than our roads? Endangered species could be attractively sponsored. Corporations can stake their reputations on the survival of animal species, as they once staked their reputations on the quality of dull television programs. And it is the same for other animals that are not yet endangered. For all the fish in the sea, we are talking about an era of magnificent corporate philanthropy on a global scale. So, this is the black rhino brought to you by Land Rover, the jaguar brought to you by Jaguar. I shouldn't put it so crudely, but yes, that's what we are proposing. The point, he continued, is that this is a win-win situation. A win for the environment, for corporations, and for advertising. Gavin Koss had done hundreds of presentations in his career, and his feeling for the audience had never failed him. He could feel now that this group was not buying it. It was time to bring the lights up and take questions. He stared at the rows of frowning faces. "I admit my notion is radical," he said, "but the world is changing rapidly. Someone is going to do this. This colonization of nature will happen. The only question is, by whom? I urge you to consider this opportunity with the greatest care, and then decide if you want to be a part of it." From the back, Garth Baker, the head of Midlands Media Associates Limited, stood. "It's quite a novel idea, Gavin," he said, "but I must tell you with some assurance that it will not work." "Oh? Why is that?" "Because someone has already done it," he said.